there are some on the call that are familiar with your ministry and that are, you know, read some of the books and everything else, but for those that are not, would you mind just telling a little bit about what you do and how long you've been doing this and just kind of a little background about yourself and all that?
Okay, very briefly. It started about 20 years ago. I started seriously studying the Bible for the first time, although I've kind of been raised with the Bible my entire life. It was about 20 years ago that I started doing some serious study, and I got a hold of a concordance and a Strong's dictionary to help me in that adventure. And one of the first words I started studying was the word soul, S-O-U-L. And I quickly realized that each translation will translate that word many different ways. In fact, the King James will translate the Hebrew word nefesh 75 different ways. And I got to thinking, well, how is it possible that if you could take one word and translate it so many different ways, how do I know what the truth is? You know, what if I plug one of these other words in there? You know? And specifically, two verses caught my eye when looking at the word soul. The first one is Genesis 1:21, and that verse happens to use the phrase, talking about creatures, animals, it uses the phrase living creatures. And the Hebrew behind that is nefesh hayah. In Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, here we're talking about man, and they translate the exact same phrase, nefesh hayah, as living soul. So I got to think, well, why, if they're going to translate nefesh hayah as living soul in Genesis 2:7, why not translate it the same way in Genesis 1:21? And I started seeing many other instances like this where I realized that the translators were translating the text in a way that they were actually interpreting the text. You know, I guess they did not want people to think that animals had a, quote, soul, so instead of using the word soul there, you use the word creature. So it was at this point that I decided I better learn the language myself. And so that's what got me started in the Hebrew language. And then it was a couple of years after that I stumbled across a article in my local paper, and it was on the Temple Ostraca. If you're not familiar with that, it's a 7th century B.C. Pottery sure that has, and the article explained it, it had this Hebrew writing on it. And I'm looking at that and go, that's not the Hebrew I'm learning. What is this? It turns out it was Paleo-Hebrew. So that's what got me started on researching the Paleo-Hebrew and the ancient Hebrew.
Huh.
So that's kind of an overview of how I got started.
Well, very good, very good. So you know what it is? It's incredibly interesting to me how you look at one translation and it's got one word and another translation has another word. And then, I don't know. So the way that you got started with the word soul, that's interesting. I never would have guessed that it would be translated 75 different ways. That's kind of...
Yeah, I didn't either.
Oh, that's crazy. That is wild. Well, very good. Well, any comments about that before we go on to some other things here? And if not...
I have a question.
Okay, go for it.
I want Jeff to tell us what the right translation is.
That's an excellent question. Okay, very briefly, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but the Hebrew word nefesh, which is generally translated as soul, like I said, it's translated in many different ways, but the majority of times translated as soul. Now, the word soul in English has a certain connotation, and it's some ethereal part of our being that, you know, you can't see, hear, feel, taste, or touch. You know, it's just inside of you. You know, a lot of people talk about what the soul is. Well, that's very Greek, and as you notice while I'm talking here over the next hour and a half, 2 hours, I'm going to talk a lot about the difference between Western thought and Eastern thought. In Western thought, we use abstracts all the time. You know, faith, hope, love, these are all abstracts. You can't touch, you can't feel, hear, taste, smell, any of these things. They're abstracts. Hebrew does not like abstract. It boils everything down to the concrete. Now, the Hebrew word nefesh, in its concrete meaning, is the whole of the person. It's his body, his mind, his breath, and breath is very important in the Hebrew mind. So it's actually the whole of the person is the nefesh, or a creature. you know, the animal, the whole of the animal is his nephesh. Okay?
Okay. So, I guess since we're on it, I don't know, maybe it wasn't a planned topic, but just out of curiosity, it's a huge discussion, and we don't want to spend too much time right now, and I'm sure people have various thoughts, but the idea of the eternal soul, or the soul that, you know, the soul that sins dies, and there's a few verses about that, but how do you see that?
Okay. It's another Greek concept of what's called dichotomy, the spiritual and the physical. That's a very Greek concept, dividing the spiritual and the physical. In Hebrew, that does not exist. There's only echad, one person. And in the Hebrew mind, your body is your body, and it cannot be separated out between physical and spiritual. A good analogy of this is religion. You know, we make a separation of church and state here in this country, and other countries do the same. Also, it's very common to separate your religious life from your secular life. However, in Hebrew, there is no word for religion, biblical Hebrew anyway. The modern Hebrew is a little bit different, but in biblical Hebrew, there's no word for religion. It's literally the way you walk. Everything you do is your religion, the way you eat, the way you talk, the way you sleep, the way you hunt, whatever. The way you raise your livestock, that is your religion. Your entire life is your religion. So when you start talking about the eternal, okay, if there is no separation from what's inside, you know, that continues on, it's all one piece. In other words, it's all going to continue. Now, how you carry that over into the afterlife, none of us really know what's going to happen there. Okay, we cannot say for sure exactly what's going to happen. Even the Hebrews didn't know what was going to happen. They used the word Sheol, which, by the way, is just the Hebrew word that means I don't know. You know, it was the unknown place. And so they didn't even know what happens after that. I do believe from an actual Jewish perspective, it's actually the physical body that continues on into the Olam Haba, the world to come.
Huh. All right. Very good. Well, I know that there may be some questions like maybe we shouldn't go into too much on that right now. Just go on to some other things. But one of the things that we were talking about was, and one of the things that we always say, and I think I had mentioned to you that just the idea of some things that you've maybe either recently found out or, you know, been excited about recently, and you had mentioned that you posted a couple of those things on Facebook recently, and I was curious if you could just maybe share those things
and
talk about that.
All right. I got a couple of them here, depending on how much time you want to spend on this.
Okay.
Well, one of them is Exodus chapter 21, verse 23, and this is the passage that talks about, well, basically it says, If any mischief follow, then shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for foot, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, strike for strike. Now, the way that that's normally interpreted by virtually everybody around the world, especially in the Middle East today, if you take out somebody's eye, then you need to take out their eye. If somebody takes a life, you need to take their life. And this is the eye for an eye, the phrase that we commonly use. And that's not what this verse is saying. And when I first read this in the Hebrew, I was like, wow, this is very interesting because this is not what this is saying. The Hebrew, for example, life for life, in Hebrew is chayim tachat l'chayim. Chayim means life. Tachat means under. Okay, it doesn't mean for, so it's not life for life. It's literally, it's translated as life under for life. But that Hebrew word tachat is often used in the Torah for something in place of something else. In other words, when it talks about these people were here and they were replaced by another people, that replacement is the word tachat. So literally what it's saying is a life in place of a life, or an eye in place of an eye. So if I cause an accident and cause my neighbor to lose his eye, what it's saying is I've got to replace that eye. Now, physically,
especially in those days, could not replace his height, but I had to give him something to compensate for the loss of that eye. For example, a servant, or I could pay him. Okay, if I accidentally killed someone, a man, let's say, for example, and I would have to replace that man, maybe with myself. I'd have to take care of his family. That would be my responsibility. So this is versus not talking about taking a life for a life or an eye for an eye. It's talking about taking a life for giving a life in place of a life or an eye in place of an eye. Okay, does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it does. That's pretty interesting. I had not heard that before, and that's I think it makes a lot of sense to me. I'm curious. Any questions or thoughts on that from anybody? I'm curious how, when it goes over into the New Testament, I don't know, how would things like when Jesus is saying that, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye, that type of thing, is, I wonder how that would work out right there, you know what I mean?
Yeah, actually, I have not looked at that. What I have found when I do study the New Testament is, especially when Yeshua is talking about the laws that the Jews all live by, he would often say, you have heard it said, but I tell you this. Now, a lot of people will take that and say, well, I think he's actually changing the law. No, what he's doing is that he's condemning the laws of the Talmud, the oral law, and he's saying that this is wrong. You're not interpreting the Torah correctly. And so what he's doing is he's interpreting the Torah correctly for them.
That makes sense, too. I think that some of those places are real, like for me anyway, in my mind, I know there's a various, number of opinions with, I'm sure, that those of us that are on the call, but like for me, there's a few of those places in Matthew there where, he's not quoting the Torah. You've heard it said, and he says something that's not written in the Torah. But then another,
exactly.
And then some of those places, though, it seems like he is quoting the Torah, but it's still along the same lines. Like you've heard it said, an eye for an eye. It is written there, but in other words, he's going to, interpret it correctly. So that's kind of the way I see that as well. But
right. Now, the Talmud will actually expound on a verse like that, and there'll be, whole volumes, discussing that verse, what different rabbis say. And all he's doing is saying that their interpretation is not correct, which, by the way, is in the New Testament, it says, what's the phrase Yeshua uses? I have not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. That abolish and fulfill are rabbinic terms. Abolish, if you and I are having a discussion on the Torah and you make an interpretation, and I say you abolished it, what I'm saying is you've interpreted it incorrectly. And I'm going to fulfill it for you. And that means I'm going to give you the proper interpretation. So that's what Yeshua was saying when he used those terms, abolish and fulfill. Those are rabbinic terms.
Well, very good. Well, that's very interesting. That Exodus 21:23, I think that's... It makes a lot of sense, because I've been kind of curious about that, life for life, eye for eye. That's good. That's awesome. So, very good. And then you mentioned you had a couple things kind of like that. Is there something else that you have that we could talk about
okay.
in a few minutes?
All right. Yeah, this is, I've been recently working on the mechanical translation and the revised mechanical translation for the book of Leviticus. And I recently came across this one verse that kind of opened my eyes to something that I thought was interesting. It's Leviticus chapter 10, verses 16 to 20. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing here, but just give you a kind of an overview here. What happens is that Aaron's sons were supposed to eat the goat sacrifice. Actually, the translations used to say burnt offering or sin offering. However, that word offering is added in the translation. It literally says they're supposed to offer the sin. Whenever you see burnt offering, sin offering, or those type of things, that word offering is added in there. Literally, that goat was the sin. Okay? So that the Hebrew strictly called that goat a sin. In other words, when you lay your hands on it, you take your sins and you place on the goat. That goat now becomes sin. Okay? Anyway, so they had brought the goat, and they were supposed to eat it as part of the sacrifice, but they didn't. They burned it in the fire. So Moses is very angry over them because they burned it. They didn't eat it. Now, then Aaron says to Moses, and this is what he says in the text itself, or in the, this is, I think, the King James translation. If I, Aaron speaking here, if I had eaten the sin offering today, should it have been accepted in the sight of the Lord? So from this translation, what he's saying is that if he had eaten it, had, that's a past perfect tense. In other words, if he had done it, would it be accepted by the Lord? Okay? However, in the Hebrew, that past perfect tense doesn't mean this. It's only the perfect tense, which should be translated this way. This is how it literally reads in the Hebrew. I will eat the sin offering today. Will that do well in the eyes of Yahweh? So what he's saying is that, I should back up here. Moses said that they need to eat it. Now, in the translation, it says you should have eaten it, but in the literal Hebrew, it says you will eat it. In other words, they charred this piece of meat to ash. It's just charcoal and ash. And Moses is telling the children, you need to eat it. You're supposed to eat it. I don't care if you burned it. You're going to eat it. You don't get that in the English translation, but that's what's saying in the Hebrew. But then Aaron steps in. He says, what if I eat it? Will that be acceptable? And Moses says, yes. So I call this a father's sacrifice. He didn't want his children to have to eat that awful mess, charred flesh and ash. So Aaron says he's going to eat it for them. And then it says that Moses heard what he said, and it was well in his eyes. In other words, it was good in his eyes because he saw him eat it, and he took care of it. And I just thought that was amazing to see a father step in and take care of that for his children.
Yeah. Well, then, man, it's so amazing how things can read so differently. Like, why wouldn't?
Oh yeah.
Why wouldn't they have just translated it in the right tense there? You know what I mean? Like, I don't understand that.
I ask myself that all the time.
I'm sure. Yeah. No, I'm sure you do. It's wild. It's I don't know. I guess it's just like what makes sense to, I don't know. I don't know why they would do that. Like why the translators would come
well,
up with things.
I think part of the problem is that we know that the Hebrew Bible was translated into Greek of about 2200 years ago to 1800 years ago over a span of time. And the Greek translators, evidently took some liberties with the text. And that is carried over into our modern translations because what I have discovered is that the translators are much more comfortable with the Greek than they are the Hebrew. Therefore, they will often consult the Septuagint when they're doing the translation, and usually they'll go with the Septuagint if it differs from the Hebrew.
Huh. So is it kind of, I know that it's funny because most of the time you think of, you know, we want the concrete and the not abstract, you know. But And it seems like Hebrew, in a sense, when you take it back, it has that concrete. But it, at the same time, the translations as it comes through, it's like very, you know, a lot of the stuff is real abstract. So maybe, like you're saying, they understand the Greek, whatever. I mean, they understand the language probably a little bit better and everything else, I guess. So
yes.
So they. So, I mean, that makes sense to me. In the Septuagint, I know. It's probably very helpful. I mean, it is very helpful, I think, in a lot of ways, but...
I agree. Yes, actually, it is very helpful. But you have to recognize that it is a translation.
Right.
Of the Hebrew, yeah.
Exactly. I guess that's the big thing. I guess that kind of clicked for me a couple years ago when I saw some email or something about how that was really the first time, the first translation that took out his name.
Yes.
And that was kind of a travesty, you know, a real problem that...
And we've been following it ever since.
And we've been following it ever since, exactly. So that's, yeah, it's something else. that's a big liberty to take in a translation. To me, it seems like that's like a big deal. So, well, man, that is very interesting. So before we get in, speaking of his name and everything else, before we go, because we're going to look at Exodus 6:3, which we've talked a little bit about on these calls in the past and just over the last year or two. But before we get into that verse specifically, does anybody have any comments so far or questions, or should we keep rolling? I know that there's things that will be spurned as we continue talking, but is anything right now that somebody wanted to jump in for a minute? All right. If not, we'll just keep rolling.
That's okay. Good.
So Exodus 6, verse 3, and again, it's one of these where, one translation reads a bit different than another. And if you don't mind, I'll just read, or if you have a couple that you wanted to look at, I'm just curious to read it before you talk about it.
Sure.
In a couple versions. And so one of the versions that I have, just the New King James, so I'm just going to read it here real quick. And so, and then another one is it's the Scriptures, which is actually similar to the New King James, but then it has, Yahweh, Yodeh, Vaveh, and Aaron and stuff, so. But in the New King James, Exodus 6:3 says, I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, the Lord, I was not known to them. With a period. So, and then over here in the Scriptures, it says, and I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as El Shaddai, and by my name, Yahweh, was I not known to them, with a question mark. So it's very different. For me, I mean, it's like you could take it as a statement or you could take it as a question mark. And if it's a question instead of a statement, it's like a whole different implication there. For, you know what I mean? So
yes. Yeah.
That's what I'm curious is to see what you've got to say about that verse.
Well, I guess before I get into it, I'd be kind of curious to how you all have looked at it. I mean, and you said you spent some time on it. I'm just kind of curious, can you kind of...
Yeah.
Give me an overview of what you guys, I won't take conclusions because personally I don't even have any conclusions on this.
Okay. Well, yeah, so I think originally it came up because somebody had mentioned that this was kind of a proof of the fact that Abraham, Isaac did not have the same commandments or laws that, that Moses, delivered. And so it was kind of a proof because, they didn't even know his name. And so if they didn't even know his name, that was just kind of like an implication that they didn't know the rest of his commandments and statutes and ordinances, and the ones that Abraham had were different. So I think that's actually how we started with that. This was kind of like a proof that they didn't even know his name, so how could they, it was just kind of like along those lines. And so, and then we looked at it, and at the time when I first read it, and it was presented, I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. Gosh, they didn't even know his name. But then I start looking back, and I, especially like in the Scriptures where it shows, the Yod Heh Vav Heh there, instead of the Lord, if it was just the Lord every time, it would be very easy to say, okay, yeah, they didn't know his name. But when you see that Yahweh is in the text, then it seems like it kind of paints a little different picture. And then, so I guess that's kind of the thing. So then there were some that, we kind of discussed it, and I think, still probably some on the call would maybe say that they didn't know his name, and then others might say that they absolutely knew his name. But
okay.
So that's I guess that's kind of the nutshell.
Okay. All right. Yeah. All right. I actually have a few different interpretations of this verse, and I'm not even sure which one is correct. Like I said, I don't even have a conclusion on this verse. But, of course, the most important thing is to get to the Hebrew text behind it. Like you did with Lord, if that word Lord is there, what's the Hebrew have? Well, it has Yahweh.
Yeah.
So that's important to go back to the Hebrew behind the English. Now, of course, the first part of the verse is correct. And I appeared unto Abraham, unto Yitzhak, and to Yaakov. No question there. That's exactly what the Hebrew says. It's the next part that gets a little tricky. I think everybody is familiar with the term El Shaddai, and that's what's here. However, if you're not aware, Hebrew uses a lot of prefixes and suffixes. For example, house is bet. If I want to say in the house, I say babet. That ba is a prefix meaning in. Or if I wanted to say to the house, that would be la bet, to the house. Okay, well, the word El of El Shaddai is prefixed with the letter bet. So it's ba El Shaddai. There's two ways that that can be translated. Most of the translations have as God Almighty. Well, that's not one translation. That's not how you would say that in Hebrew. But El Shaddai can mean in El Shaddai, or it can mean with El Shaddai. If we go with the first one, in El Shaddai, then it's possible that El Shaddai, in this case, is a place and not a name. In other words, I appeared to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in El Shaddai. Okay? So that's one way of looking at it. The other way is to say that I appeared unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob with El Shaddai. Now, this is where it gets a little tricky, because if that's correct, if that is correct, then he's talking about somebody else called El Shaddai. Now, this kind of goes in dovetail with Genesis chapter 18. I don't really want to spend a lot of time on that, but I do have an article in my commentary of the Torah, which is available for free, or by donation. I do all my donations, you know, as you can afford it, but on my mechanical translation website. But basically, you remember there were three angels that appeared to Abraham, and one of them is identified as Yahweh. Okay, then there are the other two there. He goes on with this long speech with Abraham about the righteousness of Sodom and Gomorrah. And then Yahweh leaves, and he goes to Sodom, or Gomorrah, I don't remember which one, but Yahweh leaves, and that leaves two of the angels with him. If you read the text very carefully, those two angels then go to Sodom and Gomorrah, and there's an interesting passage that says, and Yahweh rained down fire from Yahweh. In other words, Yahweh on the ground is calling Yahweh in the sky to rain down fire on Sodom and Gomorrah. Very interesting passage. It is my opinion that those two angels, those two angels are also identified as Yahweh. That gets a little complicated, but anyway, the text literally calls them Yahweh. And it's possible that one of those is called El Shaddai. Now, am I saying there's more than one Yahweh? No. It's kind of, like I said, it's very complicated. But understanding what I'm just talking about there in this verse is that El Shaddai is someone other than the Yahweh that's speaking to Moses now. Okay? All I'm saying is this is a possible translation. I'm not saying it's the correct translation, but in my opinion, I think we need to have all the facts before we can come to any conclusions. So that's why I explain all of this out.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, as you pointed out earlier, it's very clear that Abraham knew his name was Yahweh because Abraham's calling him Yahweh all the time. So we know that either we have a contradiction here in the passages or something else is going on. So the first thing to look at is the El Shaddai. What does that mean? In El Shaddai or with El Shaddai? I'll leave that at that. You guys can ponder that one.
Right.
Okay. The next thing here is the last part. And it says, literally in the Hebrew, it says, and my name, Ushmi, and my name, Yahweh, lo, not, that means not. And then, no, dati, that means I was not known. And then, lahem, to them. Okay, so literally what this is saying, and my name, Yahweh, I was not known to them. Okay, which is pretty much what it says in the English translation. However, the word yada means to know, the verb yada. In our language, I can say, I know you, Cole, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because we've had emails, we're on the phone. Okay, so I know you. However, in Hebrew, I don't know you. Because in Hebrew, the verb yada has to mean an intimacy, an intimate knowledge of something. We don't have that intimate knowledge of each other. So I don't know you. Okay?
Yep.
So it's possible what this is saying is that Abraham, while he reveals him to himself by name, he may not have revealed his whole self to them like he did with Moses. And Moses, we can all agree, had a very intimate relationship with Yahweh. And therefore, it's quite possible that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob didn't have that level of intimacy with Yahweh as Moses did.
Yeah. Seems to fit. That seems to make sense to me. I mean, as far as, so what about the question mark for the period? Like, how do we determine that?
That's a good question. Yeah, I thought about that when you said that. I did notice one translation. The ASB says, no. Oh, it's the King James that says, was I not known to them? Which is a question. Now, that is taking liberties because in the Hebrew there's no question there. There's several different ways to identify a question in Hebrew. One of those is to use a word like ma, which is what, or me, which is who, okay? Who, what, where, why, you know, those are question words. They're called interrogative participles, okay? Now, that's one way to ask, to show that you're asking a question. But of course, that's not here.
Okay.
The other common way is to use the prefix ha, an H, the letter hey, in front of the sentence. I don't know if anybody in here is learning Hebrew. Is there anybody in this conversation that is learning Hebrew?
There definitely is. I know I've been studying it, and I know there's several of us on there. I don't know if anybody wants to say anything, but there's... Yeah, for sure.
You know that if I wanted to say the house, it would be habe. Ha is a prefix meaning the. Okay? And that's very common in the Hebrew. It's used thousands of times. The letter ha, meaning the. Genesis 1:1. Ha shamayim and ha eret, the sky and the land.
Okay.
But the letter hey is also used as an interrogative prefix. It can be added to a word to create a question. And that's not here either. Okay? So there's nothing in the sentence that implies that it's a question. Nothing. It's just the translator saying, well, I've got to fix this, so I'm going to fix it. And this is how he fixed it.
Okay.
So glad they know how to fix everything.
Yeah. I like to explain that when you're reading the Hebrew text, it's like driving down a dirt road, you know, potholes and curb turns and bumps and everywhere. Well, what the translators are is the pavement crew. They come in along and pave the road so that it's nice and it flows nice and easy.
Was there, does somebody have a comment right there? You want to jump in for a minute?
Oh, well, I will. This is Tracy. Trace, I've been... can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you just fine. Yeah, go ahead. Good to have you, Tracy.
Jeff, first, I love you. You're wonderful.
Thank you.
I've been kind of studying a little bit of the whole wild idea that I find more sensible than wild is that the Yahweh of the Old Testament is the Yeshua of the New. And that I do agree it does appear as if there's more than one Yahweh, and this whole idea of a Yahweh here speaking to a Yahweh there is sort of convoluted and hard for us to get our head around. But for that whole passage that we just talked about, I don't find that to be very weird. I just see this manifestation of this person, so to speak, in these different realms, these different eras, these different places and times as being how he has to be in order to interact with us.
Okay, yeah. That actually is a very common a belief, and it's not outside the realm of possibility. There's nothing in the text that would preclude such an interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily.
I agree.
But I don't like to go into what my beliefs are. I like to explain what the text says, whether I like it or not.
Yeah. Right. Not very comfortable sometimes.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's interesting. That's a big topic. I know. No, that is very interesting.
Hey, Cole.
Yeah.
Finally, I don't know what's going on. I keep getting booted off the call. This is Sean.
Oh, really? How's it going, Sean?
Yeah. No,
I have
good,
no idea
good.
Why that would have happened, but glad you made it in.
Yeah, I had a couple of comments, but Jeff covered it just fine, as I figured he would anyway. And that had to do with the interrogatives and the question mark and all that type of stuff. But I don't know if I caught all of the last comment. One of our listeners had made a comment to a question. So I don't want to repeat it if it was already said. But that had to do with, some people call it the preexistence of Yeshua or, whatever, however we read that. I think in the text, because that's our topic here, I think it plays to the idea of Elohim, which is powers, or the powers, or, whatnot. So, people can get sideways really quick, because you start touching their understanding of Godhead and all this type of stuff, right? But I think as I caught the tail end of the last listener, I think the gist of it was saying that this is how God manifested his ways, himself, to interact with people or interact with this creation. Was that the gist of it?
I think so, yeah. That basically that Yeshua is kind of the Yahweh of the New Testament. I think that was kind of the gist of it. In other words, yeah, it's basically he reveals himself in these ways, but that's Yahweh, that Yeshua is Yahweh, and that he's the Yahweh of the Old Testament kind of a thing.
Yes, that's exactly what I was saying. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
That the Yahweh
think,
of the Old Testament is the same person as the Yeshua we meet in the New Testament.
Yeah. My personal opinion would be, without taking liberties, that would be the express image of our eternal Father, because that express image is what he created everything through, and that we call that the Word. So, in my personal opinion, although there's no exact scripture that says black and white, oh, hey, here's what this is here, but there's enough, reference or inference to that being the case, just as, when John says that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, the Word was with God, right? The same was in the beginning, and nothing that was made was not made, except it was made by the Word. So when God made anything, he spoke and he created it into existence. And it was that same Word, or in Hebrew we say that's the Ruach Kodesh, then that's that Holy Spirit that interfaced with his creation. This is how he created everything. And it just stands to reason that it's that same manifestation on how he interacts with the creation that he created. So, I mean, for me, it fits. Now, whether we can look to any scripture, Hebrew, Greek, or otherwise, I think some of these people that God walked with and talked to certainly had that idea, right? I mean, it said that, I think there's the scripture that says Abraham looked forward to this day, right? And he would be, if he was here right now, he'd be rejoicing. So that's the idea of it, that, he saw that future because of the Yahweh that he walked with and talked with. So, anyway, I'm not going to keep going down that road, but that's how I see the text, especially in the Hebrew.
Well, Jeff, do you have any comments on all that?
Well,
yeah.
I actually sit here listening to this, and, are you talking to me or the other Jeff?
No, you. Yeah, Jeff. Man.
Okay.
I know.
I know that can be confusing.
Yeah.
I have a somewhat similar
opinion. It's a little different. When you brought up the verse about in the beginning was the word in Hebrew is Zavar, and Zavar is a synonym for the Torah, because the Torah is the words of God, Yahweh. And so what I believe in John 1:1 is saying is that in the beginning was the Torah, and the Torah was with Elohim, and the Torah was Elohim. In other words, they're inseparable. Elohim's character is his Torah. It's him. Okay? Now, when Yeshua comes on the scene here, which is what John 1:14 is talking about, where it says that he took on the Torah became flesh. Let me also explain a difference between Eastern thought and Western thought. And by the way, we've all heard about the Asian philosophies of we may not know them, but we've heard about Confucius and, you know, all these other Asian Oriental belief systems. You have to recognize that the Hebrews were Orientals. Okay? They uh-huh. are an Oriental people. They have a very similar, they're more closer to the philosophy of China and Japan than they are of us in our Greco-Roman culture. Now, in the Oriental philosophy, the ego is a very powerful thing, and it's something that's always meant to be suppressed, your ego, your I, me. And you're supposed to always look towards the community. The community is much more important than the individual in the Eastern thought. And yet, if the Oriental, which I also believe the Hebrew Old Testament talks a lot about, is suppressing the ego, getting rid of the self and looking to the community, okay, looking to the whole, rather than the individual. And if you read the New Testament from a Western perspective, you see Jesus saying, I this, I that, me, I, me. It seems very selfish to me, okay, from a Eastern perspective. It seems very selfish. It seems very Western, which is contradictory to the way the Hebrew Old Testament teaches. But, however, if you look at Jesus or Yeshua, and you see that what his goal was to become the Torah, and he is the Torah, the words of God, then he is God, because he's the Torah. In other words, he suppressed himself, he eliminated himself, and he made himself nothing. I think there's a passage in Hebrews that talks about he made himself lower than the being, the angel.
Mm-hmm.
He made himself nothing, and he took on the persona of the Torah of Elohim. And he became the Torah. So whenever he speaks, it's not Yeshua speaking, it's the Torah speaking. So when he says, I am the way, the truth, and life, he's not saying me, Yeshua, he's saying I, the Torah. The Torah is the way, the truth, and life. In fact, there are verses in the Old Testament that say that the Torah is truth, the Torah is life, and the Torah is the way. You see, so it's not, it maybe Yeshua's words coming out of his mouth, but he's speaking for the Torah. So if the Torah is Elohim, then in that sense, Yeshua is Elohim.
I think that's perfectly said.
Oh, go ahead, Tom.
If I understand what Jeff is saying, is he saying that the Yeshua did not exist before the time of his birth? He's just a human that is transitioning into Yahweh? Or is he saying he always existed as Yahweh?
My personal belief, and don't take this as gospel because this is my personal belief. I have a saying, by the way, about my personal belief. I believe that everything I believe is true, but I know that not everything I believe can be true. Okay? So, what I believe is Yeshua was a man. I do not believe that he was Yahweh. However, I believe that he took on the persona of the Torah and became Yahweh through the Torah.
Okay.
But Messiah said, before Abraham was, I am. He said he existed.
Let's see. I looked at that one a while ago. What was my conclusions on that? I don't remember. Oh, yeah. Of course. He is the Torah. It's the Torah. Torah existed before Abraham. Oh, that, you were touching on this earlier. Somebody was mentioning that the Torah may not have existed for the people in the book of Genesis. That's not true, because many of the Torah commands found in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, can be found in Genesis. For example, kill. That's not kill. That's Genesis chapter 4. This clean and unclean animal. That's found in Genesis chapter 6 and 7, or 7. There's many, 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 many. I have a whole list of, you'd be surprised at how many. Although the book of Genesis never says, thou shalt not do this, you just see them obeying it. So the Torah existed from the beginning with Adam. Okay? Right. It wasn't new at Mount Sinai. So when Yeshua is speaking, before Abraham was I am, he's talking about the Torah existed before Abraham. In fact, Abraham says that he obeyed the Torah. Genesis 26, verse 5. I don't remember what verse. Thank you.
26:5.
That's it. Yeah, very good. Uh-huh. So we know that Abraham obeyed the Torah. So that's my interpretation. Am I right? Well, of course I'm right. No, I don't know. That's just my interpretation.
All right. So, Jeff Kennedy, did you have something to say?
I just got off on mute here. Sorry about that. Yeah, I just had looked at some scriptures when we were back on the other issue about whether Abraham knew the name of Yahweh or whatever. I was just going to point out that, just read a couple of scriptures and then tell you how other people see him. I see it as he definitely knew his name Yahweh because of these scriptures. But other people will say, well, you know, these scriptures in Genesis that I'm about to read, that was written down by Moses. And so when Moses wrote them down, he knew the name was Yahweh, so he inserted the name Yahweh. And so that's how they get around what I think is, you know, what is clear. So here's just a couple. I'm just going to read a few. This is before Sinai, obviously. This is Genesis chapter 4 at 26. And it says, and a son was also born to Seth, and he called his name Enos. Then it was begun to call on the name of Yahweh. And like you were saying, Cole, all the other Bible translations have Lord. So then it was begun to call him the name of the Lord. Okay, great. He didn't know his name was Yahweh, but that's not what's in the scriptures. What's in the scriptures is the name Yahweh. So then I can point that out to people and they'll say, well, this is Moses writing it down. And so he, since he knew the name Yahweh, he put Yahweh there. But the whole concept here is about calling on the name. Then it was begun to call on the name of Yahweh. So even if Moses just wrote it down because he knew it, those people back then still began to call on the name. The name. They knew the name. So Genesis 4:26 is one. Genesis 12:8.
Can I comment on that one before we move on to the next one?
Sure.
Uh-huh.
Okay, all right?
Yes.
Okay. First thing is, it's only by tradition that we believe that Moses wrote Genesis. There's no evidence that Moses actually wrote the book of that Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, that Hebrew phrase where it says men began to call upon the name of the Lord can also be translated, and I believe is a better translation, men began to meet with the character of Yahweh. Okay? Now, there's a lot of ways that you can interpret that, but I just wanted to point out that the Hebrew doesn't necessarily mean that they called upon the name. In fact, I believe that's a poor translation. I believe the better translation is that they met with the character of Yahweh. Now, who that character is can be, as somebody else pointed out, could be Yeshua, if they wanted to interpret it that way. That's a possible interpretation. Personally, I believe it is a representative of Yahweh who comes in his name. If we say, I come in the name of the president, okay, what they're saying is, I'm his character. I'm representation of him. And whoever this is representing Yahweh. Okay. Just wanted to put my two cents in on that one.
Well, isn't the word there, though, isn't the word Shem, which is name, call upon the name, the Shem, or is that not the actual Hebrew word there?
Well, yeah, I guess I should explain that the Hebrew word Shem, which is usually translated and means name, also means character.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay.
And I'll use a new... Okay. Let me also explain that the word Shem is the root of the word Neshema. Anybody know what the word Neshama means?
In the name.
So, okay, neshama is the Hebrew word for breath.
I thought you said neshama. Okay, go ahead.
Neshama. I'm sorry, go ahead. What?
What is it? What is the name for?
Okay, the Hebrew word shem is the word for name. The word shem is in the middle of the word neshama. Neshama. And you hear the word shem in there? Okay.
Yeah.
Shem is the root of this word of neshama. Neshama means breath. In Hebrew thought, your breath is your character. It's not just the exchange of air in the lungs. It's actually your character.
Right.
Your breath is
your essence.
And what?
Your essence.
Yes, exactly. And in Hebrew, whenever they gave a name to somebody, they gave them a name based on their character. And if their character changed, their name was changed, because character and name go hand in hand. So the word Shem can also mean your character, because your name is your character. You remember, we use the phrase, have a good name. You want to have a good name. Well, my name Jeff, is that a good name?
Okay. I think it is.
No, it's saying it's good. You need to be a... Yeah, okay. Yeah, you would, wouldn't you? Your name is your character. You have to have a good character. In the New Testament, let's see, Jesus says, what's the verse? I'm going to have to come back to that when I came home with it. I had it in the back of my mind. But anyway, so in Hebrew thought, your shem is your character. Your name reflects your character. So, yes, while this is translated as name, I don't think it means literally a name. I mean, I think it means the character of Yahweh.
Would you say...
Can I say something?
Sure.
This is Jimmy.
Hey, Jimmy.
You know...
Hi.
Yeah, Jimmy, in Sacramento. When I think Eliezer was... his wife was Mary's cousin... was going to have John, who was called the Immerser, they questioned him on his naming of Yohanan because nobody in his family heritage had that name previously. And so just expanding on the idea of a good name and, that idea, John, nobody in his lineage was named John. And so they kind of questioned him, why are you naming him John? And he writes on his tablet, because he was voice impaired at that time until his son was named, he said that's his name.
That's fascinating. Yes, which means gift. Yochanan means gift, and so that is related to his character. Wow, cool.
So my only question.
The verse I was thinking about earlier.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Okay. The verse I was thinking about earlier is when Paul says that you need to baptize in the name of Jesus. What exactly does that mean? I mean, we do a I was baptized as an infant in the church I was born in. And you're baptized in the name of Jesus. What does that mean? Well, if you understand the name is character, you're being baptized in the character of Jesus. And interesting, Paul said, I'm glad that I haven't baptized anybody in my name. Okay, except, and he mentioned two people. I don't remember what their names were. In other words, he's saying, I don't want to baptize anybody in my character. I want to baptize them in the character of Jesus. Also, we say in prayers, in the name of Jesus. Okay, it's almost like a formula. As long as you tack that on the end of a prayer, it'll work. You have to end it with, in the name of Jesus. It's saying in the character. In other words, my prayer is in the character of Jesus. I'm giving you what Jesus would give. Okay, in the prayer. His character.
Either way, it goes to the point that they recognized, knew, understood, aligned, or whatever words you want to use to define, they had a knowledge of, to some degree, of the name. That it wasn't this non-existent, void, unknowable thing. It was more common than we've been told in the past it was.
Yeah, I would agree. I believe that his name was known from a Western perspective. Remember, from an Eastern perspective, it means an intimate
knowledge. Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
When you say his name was known, are you talking about Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh?
Well, yes, if we're going back to that original part where I popped in on the conversation is talking about Avraham and the fact that, you know, his name was known as El Shaddai, or they knew me as El Shaddai, but they didn't know me as Yodhe Wahe. Well, I think there's plenty of texts that would allude that that's not the accurate translation.
Well, in some of these scriptures I was going to read, what's kind of to that point is that either they knew the name because he said, this is my name, or Moses or whoever wrote Genesis inserted it. But I think there's you know, reasonable evidence, much evidence, that his name was known. But in any case, Jeff Benner, I totally hear what you're saying. I agree with you that, you know, Shem and name and character, and I'm on board with that. But since Shem can be name and Shem can be character, are you at least open to the possibility that it could mean they began to call on his actual name here? Or are you not open to that?
Well, it is a possible translation. Yeah, don't get me wrong. I think that is a viable translation. I just don't agree with it.
So you're not 50-50. You're more convinced than not that it's not talking about the name Yodhe Wahe right there.
Correct.
Okay.
I think it's talking about meeting with the character of Yahweh.
Okay. Well, that doesn't...
Can I ask, do we see any evidence of either case? So can we see evidence of them either calling and using the name or some pronunciation of it, or can we see some evidence that they were aligning themselves with the character? Do we see evidence of either one of those?
Well, there is evidence that they did call upon, they did use the name. You know, I think that the text is heavily, heavy with the uses of the name by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they knew the name. I believe that they did use the name Yahweh or Jehovah or however, you know, a person wants to pronounce that.
Yeah.
But I also believe that I keep thinking about Moses when Yahweh told Moses, he says, I'm not going to the promised land with you. I'm fed up with you guys. You're a stiff-necked people. I've had it. If I go with you, I'll kill you all. Okay? He says, so instead, I'm going to send my face. Now, I think most translations say, I'll say it, send my presence. Literally, it's the word face, the panim. I'm going to send my face to go with you. So in other words, Yahweh's not going, but he's going to send his face. Well, I believe that face is angel or Yeshua, however you want to interpret that, as somebody else who's going in the character of Yahweh. Because guess who goes with them is identified as Yahweh. Throughout the whole narrative of them going into the promised land, Yahweh's there with them. But Yahweh said he's not going to go with them. Either we have a contradiction or... I'm sorry, what?
Yahweh traveled.
I'm not understanding.
I said Yahweh Tzavaot.
Oh, Tzavaot.
The Lord of hosts.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yes. And there's many other names that he goes by. And so what I see is Yahweh didn't go with Moses. Instead, he sent his face, who is Yahweh, to go with him.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? It's already a new hour here, and before we keep rolling here, Jeff Kennedy, did you want to read a couple more of those verses and then finish that real quick? Or
yeah, if you wouldn't mind, I'll keep it real quick. I'll keep it under a minute. So, anyway, if anyone's interested, these are just some interesting things that I think show that they knew the name. Genesis 4:26, I already read. Genesis 12:8, it says, and he moved from there to a mountain on the east of Bethel and stretched his tent with Bethel toward the sea. And Ai on the east, and he built an altar there to Yahweh and called on the name of Yahweh. Just another example in Genesis. Here's another one, Genesis 13:4, to the place of the altar which he had made there at the first, and Abram called there on the name of Yahweh. Genesis 15:2, and Abram said, Adonai Yahweh, that word there. Abram said, Adonai Yahweh, or however you want to pronounce it. What will you give to me? I am going childless and a son of the inheritance of my house of Eliezer of Damascus. Two more. Genesis 15:8, and he said, Adonai Yahweh, by what shall I know that I shall inherit it? Genesis 22:14. This is an interesting one. And Abraham called the name of the place Yahweh Yireh, so that it is said until this day, in the mount of Yahweh it will be seen. So he obviously knew the name. And then the last one is, this is Jacob, Genesis 28:13. And behold, Yahweh stood above him and said, I am Yahweh, the Elohim of your father Abraham and the Elohim of Isaac, the land of which you are lying. I will give it to you and your seed. So those are some biblical reasons why I think that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all knew the name. That's it.
Very good. Very good. Jeff Bennett, did you have any comment? No, those are some great verses. I love all of them, but there's a couple there that you mentioned, like where he's, you know, Abram says, and then Yahweh is in his, what he said. It's like a quote, so it seems like that's interesting. Oh, you know what? I think we lost Jeff Bennett. Let me, I'll be back in 1 second.
Okay.
I'm not sure what happened, but I'll give him a call right back and see if we can get him right back on the line here. So, okay, 1 second, I'll be right back.
All right.
And then maybe we'll continue on with a few other a few other words and things that I'm just curious. Like there's so many neat Hebrew words when you understand the meaning of that word. It just gives, at least for me, it gives me a little bit more insight into, you know, how it's used throughout the scripture. So I'm kind of curious to ask him about that. So anybody, if you have a word that you'd like to talk about, you know, let us know in just a moment. I'll be right back. Hello?
Yep.
Oh. I'm still here.
Okay, I think I hit the wrong button. Okay, I'll be right back.
Technology.
Hey, yay. It's neat. It's good when it works, but it's frustrating when it doesn't, I'll tell you.
Yeah. My funny thing is, we can send a guy to the moon, but we can't figure out how to make a conference call stick.
I was just saying this morning, can't they make a toaster that doesn't burn my toast? Come on.
Yeah.
Yeah, they make
it's good. It's good to hear Jeff. I love Jeff Benner. He's so helpful. He has such a different perspective on things.
It's neat. It's neat getting a different perspective. I've actually never talked to him or heard him before. I like his attitude on things.
Oh. Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Now you wanna read a book that'll really blow your mind? Read his book. What is it? Quantum. Oh my goodness, I can't think of the title right now. Something, quantum something in Zen. That's a perspective that really is
Genesis, Zen, and quantum physics.
There you go.
I just Googled
that's
it. That's
it.
Yeah. See? Technology.
It's a wild ride. Better sit down when you read that one, because that'll blow your mind.
We probably lost Cole now.
They're dropping like flies, son.
Well, hopefully they got the phone number they can connect back in.
Yeah.
It's either that or we'll all have to hang up and reconnect.
I think they'll be able to call back in here.
Yeah.
We'll give them another.
We'll pick them up and then conference in.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Tom. Could I jump in and say something about Jeff? Earlier, I was asking about Jeff's view on Yeshua, whether or not he preexisted, you know, his birth and physical life. And in John chapter 3, verse 13, and then again in chapter 3, verse 31, and 6:38, and 6:42, Messiah is talking about coming down from heaven. And he's saying that no one has ascended into heaven except he who came down from heaven. He's talking about no one has known or seen the Father except he who came down from heaven. He's saying mm-hmm. that he is the Son of Man who came down from heaven, that mm-hmm. he was with the Father. He says in other places, I and the Father are one.
Mm-hmm.
He's identifying mm-hmm. himself as literally being with the eternal eternally. Yeah. And when I look at the Old Testament.
For that.
Hey, this is Cole. I got Jeff back with me, and we wanted to keep rolling. But do you want to just finish that thought real quick, and then we'll keep going?
The main point is that Messiah is identifying himself as eternally being with the Father, and that he's the only one who can reveal the Father to us, and no one comes to the Father except through him. That's the whole point of why he came, was to share that relationship that he had eternally with the Father. That's why he had to enter into the physical realm as human, but be perfect. He is the living Word, but he always existed with the Father. So he came to be with us in that physical realm. And so I don't see it Jeff's way. It doesn't agree with Scripture. And one thing that I learned from the Old Testament that the Heavenly Father is continually trying to show, and it's even in the Hebrew understanding of the word or the letter or number one, it's not necessarily singularity. It means unity. And if you think about love, well, if there was only the Heavenly Father existing throughout eternity, who is he loving? And so that's what in the beginning of John 1, it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with Yahweh, and he was Yahweh. And it goes on to say, all things were made through him and for him. That's a loving relationship. That's a unity of purpose. It's doing things together, and each one's action is for the other. That's why everything it says about the eternal is love. And without that relationship of those two eternally existent beings, there wouldn't be love. But just think about that.
Hey, let me jump in. Jeff Benner, are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
Okay, super. So do you mind just, if you want to just answer those comments and questions, and then we'll move on and go to a different topic. And Tom, I thank you for mentioning that stuff. I mean, it's all some of the same thoughts that I'm thinking. I'm just kind of curious. So, Jeff, if you wouldn't mind, answering those things, and then we'll move on. I'm curious to cover a few more
okay.
things if you guys are up for it.
Sure. Actually, I thought it was a great interpretation. I liked his that's Tom, right?
Yes.
I liked your interpretation, your views of that, the whole love thing. I have not ever heard that interpretation. I like it, and I would not refute it. I would just say that I don't necessarily agree with it. For several reasons. I think that probably what I should explain is the New Testament, in my perspective, was not written in Greek originally, but in Hebrew. And then it was translated into Aramaic, and then translated from Aramaic into Greek, and now we're reading the English translation of Greek. The Bible that I use is the Aramaic Peshitta, and a Hebrew translation of the Aramaic Peshitta, which is from about 4th, 5th century. So while most Christians and Messianics will be using the Greek New Testament, I use the Aramaic New Testament. And oftentimes they are very different. Just as the Hebrew Old Testament is very different from the Greek Old Testament, the Septuagint. And so whenever I'm studying the New Testament, I'm going to compare the Greek with the Aramaic, just to see how they're different. And oftentimes they are very different. And so from a lot of my perspective, it comes from the Aramaic rather than the Greek text.
Okay. Well, very good. So did you say a moment ago that you believe that the New Testament was probably written in Hebrew and then translated
yes.
into various languages and stuff like that as,
yes.
as it went
yeah.
on? Okay.
Yeah. Now, it's my personal belief that it was originally written in Hebrew. It may have originally been written in Aramaic. Okay?
Okay.
But, there's really no way to prove one way or the other there. But I do believe the evidence is strong that the New Testament was originally written in a Semitic language, either Hebrew or Aramaic.
Yeah. Okay. I've heard some really interesting arguments about that. Some from Brad Scott, who we had on a couple weeks ago, but he's got some of his teachings, and he's kind of in passing, he mentioned some things that, for me, are pretty convincing, too. I believe that it probably was written in Hebrew.
You had Brett on last week? Oh, I wish I could have been on that one.
A couple weeks ago.
I like Brett.
Brad and I are good friends.
Good deal. We have him planned in a couple months to be back with us. Maybe we'll give you a heads up, and maybe you guys could tag team.
Yeah, I'd love that.
That'd be, be fine.
I was going to say,
hey, Cole,
go ahead.
Cole. I want to address something since we brought up Brad and Jeff and this little issue. I've got a question for you, Jeff. At least in this area, you and Brad seem to be along the same lines. And, you know, I'm a student of Hebrew, and linguistically speaking, I researched and whatnot in other languages. I've recently, in the last several years, I've been studying Hebrew. So this is in question to something Brad said. So I'm interested with your view on root words in Hebrew. So it's been my understanding that it's commonly accepted among Hebrew scholars that Hebrew is a three-letter root word system that rarely has...
How did I know this was coming up?
Okay, well, hold on. So it rarely has a two-letter root, and more rarely has a four-letter root. And we can argue added words and whatnot that sometimes there's a five-letter root, right? But I'm really interested in where is the substantiated evidence or even the empirical data that there's more two-letter roots out there. And the reason I'm asking this is because an issue came up with linking Torah and fear. So, and you linked them in your book of, which book was that? Probably a couple, but his name is One. I know that there was a quote in there where you talk about the specific link between Torah and fear, and the root of Torah, the Bira. And the root of fear, that word is a primitive root already, which is yare. So now you reduce that to a two-letter root, yar, or yodre.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah,
so,
that's correct.
So my traditional language training tells me that we're a three-letter root, rarely two. So how do you link those together? And with me saying all this and the question, I'm going to put out a retraction because my statement to someone else after Brad had spoke, I said, Brad is wrong. He's wrong because there's no two-letter root that these two come from because the whole prime is a three-letter root for each of these words, right? So I made the statement wrong, absolute. So now I'm going to say, let me backtrack. Let me rephrase it. That my belief says that is incorrect. I'm open to being shown proof and evidence that it is correct. And if we can't get absolute evidence, at least where the idea comes from, right? Maybe more empirical data or other evidence. So I'll yield to you.
There's a lot of noise. I might go ahead and mute everything out. But hey, Sean, thank you very much for the question and the comments there for sure. It was getting staticky just right at the very end, but maybe it's cleared up now. So I'll let
you
go ahead, Jeff.
Okay. Well, first of all, it was kind of crackly there. I want to make sure that I understood correctly that Brad believed that in the two-letter root as the foundation to most Hebrew words. Is that correct?
Correct.
I think that is what it was. It was just really kind of the question was on the fear of the Lord, and then so Brad went into the detail and he commented that the word fear is related to the word Torah and that, you know, Yahweh and that those two words are related. And so then that's where it came in, and then it was really the two letter and the three letter roots were really more after Brad was off the call. Our continued discussion about those words, and then that's where we kind of got more into the details. So Brad never addressed the two-letter, three-letter root, though.
Okay. Well, I can tell you that years ago when Brad and I talked, he did not believe in my philosophy of the two-letter root. He held to a three-letter root. But the more we talked about it, he came around to my way of thinking. So at least that was the way it was a couple of years ago, so I assume he still believes in a two-letter root. But we had some very interesting conversations on this very issue. As far as empirical evidence, I stumbled across
the idea that there that all Hebrew words were related to a two-letter root based on finding that many words had similar meanings that came from the same two-letter root. As an example, the fear and the Torah. Now, we don't see any connection between those two in our philosophy or our way of thinking. You know, we're supposed to love the Torah, not fear it. Okay, well, that's from our Western way of looking at it. But in Hebrew, fear is a good thing. In fact, it's not even really fear at all. It's actually awe. It's being in awe of something. Have you ever seen something that was so magnificent you could feel it in the pit of your stomach? I mean, I had that experience when I first saw Mount Rushmore. You know, when I stood there and looked at that, it's just I had that feeling in the pit of my stomach. I'm like, my gosh, this is awesome. That's what the word fear means, is to have that feeling. Now, it could be from being scared, or it could be from something awesome. And what is the Torah? But it is something awesome. It's something that you feel in your gut, okay? So there's that connection there. I'll give you another example here of a good example of how one two-letter root can spawn many related words. And that's the word chum. Okay, it's spelled het mem. Now, this word means hot, H-O-T, hot, hem, or ham. One of Noah's sons' name is Ham. He was hot-headed, which I think why they call him that. Anyway, from that word hem comes the word chemet, which is a skin bag. Think of a goat skin, the soda to put liquid in. Okay, there's chema, which is cheese. There's Chama, which is the sun. Chamath, which is to shake. Chamad, which means to crave or desire. And chamat, which means to sour. Now, when I was studying these, my first thing was, well, these, you know, I had already come to the conclusion that all words come from a two-letter root. But I'm looking at these and I go, what do these have to do with calm being hot? These words have nothing to do with each other. So I literally spent days researching this, and I found out they all do have something in common. And it is that they would take milk and put it in a skin bag. Okay? The skin bag has a natural enzyme in it that separates the water from the milk, the cheese, the curds, and the whey. And that bag is hung out in the sun and the heat, and it is shaken back and forth, and it sours the milk. And it is a desired food. This cheese that this makes is a desired food. So you can see that the word chum, which means hot, is related to all of these words, the skin bag, cheese, sun, shake, crave, and sour. And they all come from chum. Now, chum, in the original pictograph, was spelled with two letters, the chet, which is a picture of a wall, which means to separate. The mem is a picture of water, meaning to separate water. You see that picture in there, separating the water from the milk. Now, another word that comes from chacham is chacham, which is wisdom. Wisdom is also a separating. It's the ability to separate between good and bad, right and wrong, left and right. Skill is also the word. Chacham means skill, to have the skill to be able to do something. So all of these words come from the one root, chum, and they're all related very closely. And I can show you example after example after example of this, where we see the two-letter root spawning many other three-letter roots from that two-letter root.
Okay. Now, I believe you reiterated that example that's in your book, Learn to Read Biblical Hebrew, correct?
Okay, if you say so.
Well, I read them all, so that's why I'm referring to some of
them. Thank you.
So I'm really happy that you're on the call. I mean, because you have taught me a lot. And then I went into I furthered my studies and went into a more traditional linguistical program, right?
Well, let me make one other comment. You talked about the judiciary.
Sure.
Most all Hebrew scholars recognize the fact that it's a possibility that the three-letter roots come from a two-letter root. Even Wilhelm Justinius said that.
Uh-huh.
Rabbi, the
Theological Dictionary of Hebrew.
Right.
The Rabbi Samuel Raphael Hirsch made that mention. There's actually several well-known Hebrew scholars who have postulated the idea that it's possible. Okay. All right. Sorry, go ahead.
Sure. No, that's okay, because that's kind of where I was going with my question, because, I think you would agree that when I say traditional linguistical training, stops at the three-letter root, right? Professors that I've talked to said, no, we don't have any hard evidence, meaning that maybe there's that some that, like you've said, have postulated this idea, but no one has come to the concrete and say, absolutely, there is. So, I mean, I'm okay with things being even theoretical and saying, well, I could believe that, right? But we don't.
Right.
I guess what we don't have is large amounts of this data that we can go to. So, correct me if I'm wrong. I think your perspective in reading Paleo Hebrew, and not necessarily ancient Hebrew, but before Paleo Hebrew. But when you read Paleo Hebrew, that leads you to believe that there are more two-letter roots than what we commonly understand or think of.
Well, I do believe there were more two-letter roots than what we find in the Bible. Yes, I believe that they did exist, and we may not have a record of them, but I do believe they existed. I mean, not all Hebrew words found in the Bible.
Sure. No, I get that. I understand the difference between common or lingua franca, right, and biblical Hebrew.
Right.
So, I mean, I get it. The same thing happens with Koine Greek, right? So, these things happen. So, I was trying to really look at, and this is why I retracted my hardcore absolute, because this is what I believe, because this is what I understand and learned, right? So here's a delineated point. We know that we can take this back to the three-letter. So if we stop there and we take these two words, just in text, we take these two words, yara and yare, and we take them back to a root, they both go to a separate three-letter root. It's not until you take them back to an idea that they go to a two-letter root of yud and rosh, aresh.
Right. Right.
Okay. So on that basis, I'm willing to stay open because there's not enough evidence either way.
You're right, and there's a lot of people that disagree with me on this. However, I believe looking at the evidence, like based on my ancient Hebrew lexicon of the Bible, where I grouped everything to its two-letter root, I believe that that is sufficient evidence to suggest that everything goes back to a two-letter root. That is my opinion, and I'm holding to it.
Sure. No, absolutely. And I think when I was talking with the other Jeff the other day regarding these types of things, and I think I used your example of the milk and the heat being in the skins making cheese, and I butchered it. But that was the idea that I was leaning on. I am open to that. Yeah. Okay. I'll let other people talk now, but, thank you for coming. And I I'm really excited to be able to talk to you because from a couple years back when I stumbled on to your documents, I mean, I've went through them and I think you're a good teacher and I share those tools that you put out there. So thank you.
That's great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, super. Well, hey, thanks, Sean. And, well, you know what I was curious is we're already halfway through our last hour here. Are you still okay to stay with us for a little bit longer, Jeff?
Yes.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, what I would love to do is there's a few, I come across these things and there's like a word that I find and I'm sure as people first learn Hebrew and they learn a few things and it's shared at a different, feast or wherever, some teaching you hear and you hear these really neat little intricate, details about some word that has all this definition, all this substance in it that we never really knew just, reading the word in English or whatever. So I'm curious, like of those types of things, do you have a few that you you know, the, like for maybe people that aren't, have no idea of the roots and stuff, like I'm a little bit lost, you know, when it gets too much into detail on some of the Hebrew, which I'm still in the very beginning stages, but just some real kind of fascinating words that you found that are interesting that you think some of the people on the call would appreciate.
Okay. This is one that I found a long time ago, and it was kind of my first introduction to realizing that you need to get to the meat of the text. You need to really look at the text for what it says, because a lot of times the translations aren't really giving the whole picture. And this verse is Exodus 34:14. And it says in the King James, "For thou shalt worship no other God, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God." Now, I've always read that and thought, wow, God's jealous. How can a God be jealous? You know, like a husband is jealous for a wife, or a wife for a husband. And that just really made no sense to me whatsoever. But then I started looking at this word, and the Hebrew word is kana. It's spelled kuf nun aleph. And when you look at, and we're going to go to the two-letter parent root of it, okay, because I believe everything that comes from the two-letter parent root. The parent root is kan, which is kuf nun. Now, if you look at the pictograph of that, you have kuf, which is the sun of the horizon, and it means to gather. Okay, imagine the sun setting, all the light is gathered right there. Or if the sun is setting, all the light is gathered right there at the sun. So this kuf means to gather. Noon is a picture of a sprouting seed, a sprout. And it also, the word noon means air, H-E-I-R, or a progeny or offspring. So when you put these two together, you have to gather the offspring. Ken. Now, ken is the Hebrew word for a nest, which is where the bird goes out and gathers all of the material to create a home for its offspring, to gather the offspring. Okay? Now, from ken comes another word, kana, which is kuf nun hay, and this means to build. As in Genesis 19, it has been said, "Blessed is Abraham," or Avram, "to God Most High, builder of heaven and earth," or possessor. Some translations have possessor. It literally means builder, like building a nest. So from this verse, we can see that kana means to build is like building for a nest. So the imagery here that I think the author of this text is trying to portray is that God created the heavens and the earth as a nest for his offspring, us. Okay? And then when we come back to kana, kuf nun aleph, that's the word translated as jealous. It is not jealous, but to guard, like a mother would guard over its chicks or its baby birds. Okay. So now we have this imagery of Yahweh protecting, not necessarily jealous, but protecting its offspring, its children, which is us. Another word is kane, which means a spear. That word is used for a spear. And I don't know if you've ever seen this, but my son once was walking through the zoo, and a bird came out of his tree and pecked him in the head and went back up into the tree. It turns out that these birds, when they feel threatened, they'll attack with their beak. Their beak is like a spear. So you can see all of these words playing on each other. There's one example of a word that I found very interesting in the use of the text that helped me to interpret the text more correctly.
Hmm. So with that said, it's interesting because just about a week ago I was talking with somebody that may or may not be on the call, I'm not sure if he is or not, but we were talking about that, the jealous God, and that, and he said, if I'm not mistaken, that it would actually be better translated as a zealous God, that I'm zealous for you.
Yeah, I think zealous is better than jealous. But I think protection or guarding of that concept would go with the word zealous.
Okay.
Adding that to the idea of zealousness.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. Very good.
And I can say when you're talking about that gathering under the wing, a builder of a nest like a mother bird, once again, you'd see Yeshua saying, "How many times would I have gathered you underneath my wings, but you would not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, good. Well, you know, while we still have some time, are there any other ones that you'd want to share? And then if so, in either way, I'd love to have you talk just a minute about Shavuot. But did somebody else, was somebody going to say something right there?
I was trying to.
Okay,
I'll try to make it short. The commenter just sparked my mind on something, and it has something to do with the words. When she talked about the illustration of being under the wings of a bird, and when you do the word study on the wings of a bird, the same word keeps coming up, the same family, and that comes back to tzitziot. You know, the same reason when the woman touched the wings or the hem of the garment. But in the Old Testament, this is, keeps being referred to, and it's referred to with birds of the wings or the feathers, and then it directly is related to the tzitzit.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Again, it shows the concreteness of the Hebrew language. No. Yeah. We use the word tzitzit or translated as fringe. What a lot of people may not know is that word comes from the word tzitz, which is a blossom. And I remember when I was studying this, I'm thinking blossom and a fringe. What in the world are these two? They don't even look alike. I mean, how could they be related? And then it just dawned on me that look alike, that's Greek thinking, what something looks like. It's how things function is what is Hebraic. So if you look at that and you find out that the blossom of a tree functions exactly the same way as a tzitzit or the fringe on the corner of the garments do. And this, the text says that the fringe is there to remind you to do the Torah. In other words, it's a reminder to produce fruit, fruit being the actions of the Torah. And that's what a blossom does. You know, once the blossom goes away, the fruit comes through it. So the tzitzit and the blossom, and that's why the word tzitzit comes from the word for blossom.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Cool.
It's awesome.
Very neat.
How about the word tzion?
Tzion, excuse me, that's a signpost, a landmark. Actually, I have a whole study somewhere. Oh, I have it in the commentary for my mechanical translation commentary at mechanical-translation.org. You can download my commentary, and I have about a 300-page commentary. It goes into a lot of this stuff. And I just ask for donations. You know, I have a suggested price, but if you can't afford it, you can take it for free if you can for more, that'd be great to help those other stuff, you know. So please avail yourself of that. Go to the website, download the commentary, and you'll find a lot of these things. As far as Zion, it's a word that literally means a landmark. And we don't think much about it in our day and age because we have maps and road signs. But in the ancient world, they use landmarks to guide them on their way. And the way, HaDerech, is our path, our journey on the Torah. And on this path are all of these landmarks. And the ultimate landmark is the mountain called Zion, or Tzion. And anyway, like I said, I have a whole article on Zion and how it's related to other words and the way, the journey.
And how the thoughts that I heard, whether they're correct or not, or if you have an opinion towards them, regarding the word meaning a dry and parched place.
We think of a dry and parched place. You know, a lot of times what we think of as negative is actually positive in the Hebrew mind. A dry and parched place isn't necessarily always negative. It's part of the journey. A good example of that is flood. You know, we think of a flood as a very bad thing, but in the Hebrew mind, a flood is a very good thing because without it, there would be no crops. Because the flood brings a rich, nutrient-rich soil from the mountains down to the lowland. You know, so a flood was a very good thing, you know. In the Hebrew mind, the same thing with dry and parched earth. You know, it's, you know, dry and parched earth, that English translation, that sounds very negative, but that's their home. You know, the Near East where these people lived as shepherds, that was their home. That's where they lived.
Right. Now, I have one quick question. It's more funny or rhetorical than anything. It's, where does a girl go to learn how to be a Hebrew?
Oh, lots of places. Teachers like Brad Scott.
Yeah, yeah. It is very challenging to separate yourself from the Western mindset.
Well, you know, speaking of that real quick, is that, would you mind just giving a little bit on the word Hebrew and what that means?
Oh, sure. Okay. Ivri in Hebrew. An Ivri is a person who was born from Eber. E-B-E-R is what most translations have. That's like the great-great-grandfather of Abraham. I don't remember exactly how many generations, but Eber, or Ever in Hebrew, is all of his children are Ivrim. Ivrim is plural. People born of the tribe of Eber. So that's what Ivri is. Now, the language is Ivrit. Ivrit is the language spoken by Hebrew people.
Okay. So what about...
Oh, also, I guess I should comment that the word ever means to cross over.
That's what I was hearing.
You know, yeah, a lot of find that very fascinating, me as well, that for some reason Eber was called the one who crosses over, and his children are those who cross over as well, which is very interesting. We tie that in with the New Testament, crossing over, all that, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was curious. So basically, would that be like the root of the word, or kind of more of the physical ancestor of Abraham, I guess, that the word kind of comes from then, that's the word that means to cross over or whatever?
Yeah, the verb form avar means to cross over,
okay.
And the noun form ever is one who crosses over, which would be Eber.
Okay, so would Eber be translated as just Hebrew?
No, Eber would be translated as crossing over.
Crossing over. Okay, I got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, you know, so maybe for the last few minutes, if anybody has any other questions, then maybe we could do that, and I have one last thing that I was curious to ask you about, and it's just, and I think I mentioned it to you earlier, but basically, when I think of the Feast of the Lord, I remember about 10 years ago, somebody mentioned a book about the feast, and I thought, man, why would you look at that? Like, it was just like this mind-boggling thing, like somebody would study the feast, but since that time, I mean, I love them, but I feel like when I study them and I read and I look at these graphs and I see these pictures and I feel like I get a little bit of understanding, but I always, like when somebody says, well, tell me about the feast, I'm like, well, I feel like it's just like this vague kind of blankness in my head that's like hard for me to put out there. But specifically with Shavuot, which depending on the calendar, I know everybody, you know, there's obviously various calendars and everything else, but I think this year a lot of them are lining up pretty close. So Shavuot would be like this coming Sunday. So right now we're in this time of counting the Omer. And would you mind just talking a little bit about Shavuot, kind of
sure.
Significance? And I know we've heard and we've even talked about on these calls that, you know, 3,000 people died on Mount Sinai, and then 3,000 people were saved at, you know, Pentecost type of thing and same day, and it's a very significant thing. And then, so if you wouldn't mind just maybe addressing that and whatever you think about Shavuot.
Okay. Yeah, it's been a long time since I've looked. My favorite part of studying Shavuot is from the New Testament and what the New Testament has to say about this in Acts chapter 2. There is a lot of imagery in this that relates to Jewish traditions, a lot more. In fact, let me just pick a couple of verses out here. This is verse 2. And suddenly there came a sound from heaven as a rushing mighty wind, and it filled the house where they were sitting. I think most of you probably know that it's traditionally held within Judaism that Shavuot, or when they went to Mount Sinai in Exodus for the first time, traditionally, it's not identified in the text, but traditionally it's believed that that was Shavuot. So we already right here have a connection between the thunder and the lightning and the rushing wind at Mount Sinai, and we have that here in Acts chapter 2 also happening. Now, where were they celebrating Shavuot? Let me ask this question here of you people. Where do you think they were in Acts chapter 2? Where were they celebrating Shavuot?
Well, I just saw this teaching about 2 weeks ago called The Upper Room from Chaim Goldman, I think. And
mm-hmm.
So anyway, so I have an answer. I don't know if anyone else has any thoughts on it. And I don't know if I'm right.
So they were in Jerusalem in the temple area or in the mount area.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, they were at the temple.
That's right.
They were at the temple. Yeah. They weren't in the upper room. It doesn't really say, but I think it's implied well enough based on the text here that they were at the temple, which they were commanded to be. You know, all Jews had to be at the temple on Shavuot. So they were standing there at the temple, which is a picture of Mount Sinai. So you have a duplication of what's going on in Exodus with what's going on here in Acts chapter 2. And then verse 3, and there appeared unto them cloven tongues of fire. There was fire on Mount Sinai. And they were all filled with Ruach HaKodesh and began to speak in other tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. There is a tradition in Judaism that when God spoke the Torah from Mount Sinai, I guess we ought to go back a little bit. It wasn't just Jews that came out of Egypt. I don't know if anybody's aware of this. There's a passage that says there was a multitude of other people that came with them. So there were many nations there, not just Jews, but many nations who came with Israel. And the tradition within Judaism is that when God spoke the Torah from Mount Sinai, everyone heard it in their own language. Okay? And we have that here as well. And they all heard them speaking in their own language. So, again, it's a duplication of what happened on Mount Sinai.
If I can add to that, Jeff, can I interrupt real quick?
Yeah.
We do have in Torah where it says that everyone heard the voice of God. So there's this implication that each person heard God speaking to them at this very same time. So each person heard him individually, and that's when they cried out and said, "This is too much for us. We can't handle this. We don't want this." Right? And so I just wanted to add that's also added, and it backs up the tradition of what's believed. So
yes, exactly. Yeah. Like I said, it's been a long time since I've actually lived this. There's a whole lot more to it, but those are the ones that just come to my mind. Most of my studies are in the Old Testament, not so much in the New Testament. But anyway, so that's what I see as far as with Shavuot. What the Christians will celebrate, while they'll celebrate Pentecost, they don't even recognize that this is a Jewish holiday. And I find it odd that if you mention you're observing the feast, they look at you like an evil Pharisee, but if you don't celebrate Christmas and Easter, you're also an evil Pharisee, you know. Christmas and Easter are not even mentioned in the Bible. Well, except King James mentions Easter, but I think we're all familiar with that. But these are the feasts that God gave to his children to observe, and he commanded that we observe them. And yet, we don't, you know. I talk with Christians about the Feast of First Fruits, and they go, "Oh, that's another one of those Jewish holidays." I go, "Well, first of all, they're not Jewish holidays; they're Yahweh holidays." Secondly, did you know that Jesus rose from the dead? Isn't Jesus called the Feast of First or the First Fruits of the Risen? They go, "Yeah." I go, "Do you know that he rose from the dead on Yahweh's feast called First Fruits?" They go, "Really?" You know, they start making that connection. You know, and I just don't understand why more and more people are not observing these when there's so much history, so much, I want to say flavor, so much of God within them.
So one thing you just said is you don't understand why more people aren't observing these things. So my question is that, because it's something that we've talked about many times with a lot of people and stuff, and basically, like, you know, how do we keep the feast? Lamb, we're not doing this, but what are we doing? And so something just recently, and the word observe that you said a minute ago, I'm just curious because, like, somewhere recently I heard this idea of, in the same way that we remember the Sabbath day, that it's kind of like the same thing that you act on behalf of from, you know, that kind of idea. So remember, it's not to recollect, but to act on behalf of. But
right.
And so, like, to guard or to keep or to observe, Somebody recently told me that it's kind of a similar meaning, but what is that, right? Is that connected to the idea of acting on behalf of? In other words, you're not going to go down and do everything exactly, and there's no temple, obviously, there's no sacrifices that we're going to be making today for this feast, but so we're not keeping it the way people want to say, how are you going to keep the feast? You know what I mean? That type of thing. But what does that mean to keep, observe it or whatever?
Well, the word remember or zakhar in Hebrew means, like you said, doesn't mean necessarily just to recall something, but to actually act upon something, a memorial. In fact, the word memorial, I forgot exactly what the word is, but it comes from the root zakhar. It's related to it. It's a memorial. So all of the feasts are memorials of the events that took place in Exodus, and they're being repeated. Now, even within Judaism, they cannot keep them the way they were supposed to because they don't have the temple. They don't have all these other things that they're supposed to have. And so what Judaism has done is they've created, and that's part of what the Talmud does, is a system or a way of keeping these feasts as best as they can under the circumstances that they live within. And I say that's the same way that Messianics can do that as well, or Christians for that matter, that they can keep it as best as they can with what they have or what they know. A lot of people say, well, I can't change my whole life and start observing all these seven feasts and everything. You know, that's just, you know, I don't understand it. No, you don't have to. God doesn't expect everybody to immediately start doing all of this immediately. You start with one thing, just one thing. And then you expound on that next time. You know, maybe the next feast you'll do a little thing with it, and you just get better and better and better at it. You know, God, that's actually something that's very important. Perfect. You know, Christians have this idea that you have to be perfect, you know, and you can't be perfect. Well, yes, you can. Even John the Baptist's parents were perfect, according to Luke chapter 1, verse 60. They were blameless in the sight of God. You see, in the Greek mind, perfection is without any error. In the Hebrew mind, perfection is maturity, to be mature in something.
Hmm. Yes. Well said, Jeff.
Thank you.
Very good, very good. Well, the last few minutes here, I'm just curious if anybody has any, you know, we could do kind of a, if you're up for it, Jeff, maybe like a rapid fire, just any
sure.
questions, any
sure.
quick questions, and kind of get your opinion on different things. And I've got a couple that I'm kind of curious, but I don't want to hog the show here, so if anybody wants to ask anything else, now's certainly an opportunity to do that, if you have any quick questions. And if not, then I definitely will keep going, because I'm curious.
No.
Did somebody have something or no? Okay, so when you mentioned that all the feasts are a memorial, so like with trumpets, because my understanding is the spring feasts are kind of represent the first coming, the fall feasts, generally speaking, kind of picture his second coming, and that's always made really good sense to me, and that's why I'm always so curious, and like when I mentioned earlier that there's like this blankness in my head of, you know, some of the feasts, especially with the fall feasts, it's like, man, I learn, I study them, I read this stuff, and I kind of have an understanding of them, but how are the fall feasts also a memorial, and wouldn't it be even more so? I guess even Passover was a memorial before he died, so that's why they were doing it, and then he ultimately fulfilled it in that way. But so is that kind of how you see that? I mean, are the fall feasts kind of in the same way? They just maybe haven't been fully fulfilled. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, I don't have much of a comment on that because I don't really study the feast much.
Okay.
You know, other than the grammatical perspective of them, unfortunately, that's where most of my studies are, is grammatical and the vocabulary. So, but yes, I would see them as all seven feasts are a memorial of something that has happened and something that will happen.
Okay. Okay. Good deal. Well, hey, Jeff Kennedy, do you have any last questions or comments or thoughts?
Well, I just something that kind of came up today, maybe if we could address it real quick just to get Jeff Benner's perspective. I've had this question for years now because I hear it often, and I've never understood it. But it's about Paul's words when he says, if I yet preach circumcision, why am I yet persecuted? Okay? So let's go there. Galatians 5:11. Now, when I read that, to me, it's very clear. It says, if I still preach circumcision, or if I yet preach circumcision, why do I yet suffer persecution? Or, NIV, brothers, if I am still preaching circumcision, why am I still being persecuted? And so in any translation I read, it's pretty clear to me that he's saying that, he, you know, both is happening. If I'm still preaching circumcision, why am I still being persecuted? But what people are telling me and have told me for years is what Paul is really saying is I am not preaching circumcision, but I am being persecuted. It makes no sense to me at all. I mean, I don't even see how they can get there. So how do you read that verse? What is Paul saying? What's the point of that verse?
When it comes to the New Testament, I'm more of a student than I am an actual teacher, just because I have a lot to learn with the New Testament, and it's not an area that I study as much as I do with the Old Testament. However, I will share with you a book that I read that I thought was fabulous when it came to the book of Galatians, and that was by, does anybody know what book I'm talking about? It's called Galatians by, Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Have you heard that book before, or read that book before?
I have that book.
I've seen parts of it, yes.
I have.
Okay. I highly recommend it. It opened my eyes to a lot of things in the book of Galatians, and also Romans as well. And so I'm going to leave it at that, just because I don't have an answer for you.
All right. Well, then let me just ask you a personal opinion. When you read that verse, how do you understand what Paul is trying to say?
Okay, it sounds like he's preaching circumcision, and he's being persecuted for it. Within the Jewish communities in the first century, there was a big split on circumcision. That was a big issue in the first century, just like it is today.
Right.
More so than it is now. And I studied this a little bit, and what I found most interesting is, you know that the Torah never, never commands circumcision?
In Leviticus, it does on the eighth day.
Yes, it tells them to circumcise at that time. It never says all your children. And I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact verses or exactly how it's worded, but it's worded in such a way that it doesn't really command circumcision. It does tell them to do it at certain times, but it almost appears, and I'm not saying one should be or should not be circumcised. To me, it's still an open question. But the only command as far as circumcision in the Torah is to circumcise the heart. We are commanded to circumcise the heart.
Well, I don't know about that. Leviticus 12:3. On the eighth day.
Well, let's take a look at it.
Leviticus 12:3. On the eighth day, the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised.
Yeah, you're right. It does say that, doesn't it?
I think it's a command. I'm pretty sure it's a commandment, just like any of the other commandments. But then, you know.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm mistaken there. You are absolutely right.
Well, something that I heard that might be, I'm not sure if this is maybe what, and it's it reminded me because a couple of reasons, but one of the versions of the Bible that we read is from the Aramaic, and he is very adamant that that in the New Testament it's not commanded that men would be circumcised, but only the commandment in Leviticus there for the 8-day old boy. And so, and ever since I heard him say that, and then I started to look, and it's like, that seems to fit, at least for me. And I know there's a very wide range of people's views on this topic on the call, but for me, it seems to me that Leviticus is definitely a command with the child. But then, and then even in Acts, I think it's 24, where he says, you know, they were, you know, falsely accusing him of teaching against circumcising their children, but he was not. And then he went and proved that he was not teaching against circumcising their children. So for me, it kind of fits. Like if you're, you know, and then he says over in Romans and Corinthians about if you're called an uncircumcision, don't seek to be circumcised. And you know what I mean? So for me, it kind of fits like the idea that if you're called an uncircumcision, don't be circumcised. But I know this is a hot topic, but another the idea that the only command, and maybe this is what you're saying, I'm not sure, but that the only command is for the 8-day-old boy, not necessarily for an adult that comes to faith or whatever.
If I remember correctly, back when I was saying this, there's a passage, I don't know if it's in Joshua, after they arrive in the land, everybody is supposed to be circumcised?
Before, actually. Before,
okay,
before they enter.
Right. Well, my question at that time, and it's still a question. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Hello?
I'm not sure. Go ahead.
I wanted to jump in. Just a comment that when the commandment for circumcision, you know, and all the commandments were essentially given, it's true that Israel was living as a community together. Now, that is not the case today or even in the time of Yeshua, but at least somebody was in the, you know, a tribe was in the land, therefore meeting all of the qualifications, you know, so that Yeshua could come and live in a Torah observant environment, even if it wasn't walked out perfectly. But my point is that they were living as the entire community together, hence the Zitziot, you know, the commandment for the ZCO and all of that. Is that a factor, or would that be a mitigating factor in this circumcision discussion?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I know there's different viewpoints. I know, like, Mani Judah is one who thinks that there are certain commandments that only apply to when you're in the land of Israel, some of this, some of that. But I would be open to it, but if you just want to single out, not you, but if someone wants to say, well, circumcision doesn't apply because we're not in a, you know, theocratic society governed by Yahweh or whatever, then we have to throw out, you know, all of the other ones that are right in the same chapters and verses. And so it would just be a little troublesome for me to say, well, these apply, you know, tithing applies and this applies and that applies, but these three don't apply, even though they're in the same chapter. So I just look at it as if, you know, any commandment in Scripture is just as equally important, you know, or, you know, it should be observed as best of your ability. I don't really distinguish them. But I know what you were going to say, I was going to say this too, Jeff Benner, is when I'm reading Paul's stuff, you know, it's clear that he addressed the topic of circumcision, but to me it's pretty clear that, you know, there was a group going around, a circumcision group, telling everybody they had to do this and do that to be saved. They had to be circumcised. They had to keep the law of Moses to be saved. And the whole context to me, when I read it, is salvation. And he was saying, absolutely not. That's false. That's a false gospel. And he was fighting against that, whereas I don't really see him fighting against, you know, any commandment, including physical circumcision.
Well, you have to consider this, I think, when you're talking about Passover. It is very apparent from how I understand that if you are going to partake of the Passover, you must be circumcised. And so whether or not you are held accountable because your parents didn't do it when you were 8 days old, or you have the responsibility to do it now, like the multitude that came out from Egypt with us, they had to partake of those kind of commands in order to be grafted in, so to speak, to be part of Israel, was to do those things that were commanded of Israel. You're either in the one group or you're outside the one group. And I find it funny that Shaul uses it as a bragging point. And I also find it peculiar that Moshe did not circumcise his sons.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of related to what I was asking earlier, the question that I had before they went to the promised land, they had to be circumcised, but if they were obeying the command in Leviticus, they should have all been circumcised already. Why
that's
weren't
right. They weren't obedient to many things in the wilderness. they were not good. They were not doing good. They just
right. Right. A stiff-necked, rebellious bunch.
Oh, my goodness.
That's right.
Hi, this is Tom. Can I jump in?
Yeah, sure. We should close it up pretty quick. But, yeah, if you want to say something real quick, Tom, for sure, and then We should actually close. I was just about to say we should close this up for sure, because I don't want to keep everybody too long here. So we should close it up. But yeah, go ahead real quick then, Tom.
I might seem like I'm disagreeing with you, but on the Galatians where it says, Paul, if I'm still teaching circumcision, why am I being persecuted? But he goes on to say, then the stumbling block of the cross is abolished. And if you go back, circumcision was a commandment given to Abraham originally as a sign of the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, Messiah said that this is the new covenant in my blood. So the covenant blood really wasn't poured out until the cross. So the stumbling block of the cross is literally pointing to the sign that would be of the new covenant, meaning the Messiah making the sacrifice of his blood, his poured out blood, to impart or to share that life with you, his spirit. So that's why in Pentecost you receive a spirit, which is literally the law or his commandments coming into your heart, that you should obey him and keep his commandments and be in that covenant relationship with him. That's the covenant. So he's talking about circumcision that they were preaching as the sign of the covenant was now being explained or revealed as that pouring out of the life of the Messiah as he suffered on the cross. So the cross became a stumbling block to the Jews because they were looking to the sign of circumcision as the sign of the covenant. But Paul goes on in the next verse in Galatians, he said, well, let those who are, you know, putting you in trouble or turmoil, let them mutilate themselves. He's saying, you know, cut them totally off. You know, he's really, in a sense, opposing the misuse of circumcision. But he's not necessarily saying the commandment is wrong because it was a sign. But now we're looking to the suffering of Messiah on the cross and the pouring out of his life so that we might receive a spirit. That's the covenant, you know, relationship. And it really was intended with Abraham too, because Abraham was led by the spirit of Messiah, and the sign of circumcision was only a sign of something he already received. He already was in that covenant relationship. So the Jews were looking to the sign itself as the covenant relationship. And that's what Paul is really arguing, is that, no, circumcision in the flesh is only a sign of something that should be in your heart. And that's what Scripture continually says. And that's where Messiah's suffering should turn your heart to him to receive the Spirit. So you could be in that relationship of salvation.
Yep.
So that was a stumbling block he's really talking about.
Huh.
Very nice.
Yeah, and you...
Very nice.
Well, we should definitely get those up here. If somebody has one last thing real quick.
I just wanted to say, and you reconcile that against the fact that it says that he was slain from the foundation of the earth.
Okay. Well, Jeff Benner, do you have any last comments, or should we close it out?
No, I just say thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. I had a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it.
Good. Good deal. Well, super. Well, we very much appreciate you taking the time and being with us. And we'll, you know, maybe if you're up for it, maybe we'll do it again down the road sometime for sure if you're up for it. And so,
okay. We'll keep in touch with me, Cole.
For sure, I will. And then, hey, would you mind just closing us out in prayer?
Sure.
Be great.
Sure. Avinu Malkeinu, our Father and our King, we thank you for this opportunity for brothers and sisters to share together in your word, in your Torah. We ask that you use your words to guide us through our lives and in our work, in our play, in our home, and bring us to a better understanding of who you are and who your son Yeshua is. In the name of Yeshua, in the character of Yeshua. Amen.
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 Thanks, Jeff.
Yep.
Thank you,
guys. Thank you very much, Jeff. And hey, anybody that...
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you again, Jeff. And then... next week, we've got another guest on with us, L.A. Marzulli. So it'll be some interesting discussion, and it should be a lot of fun. So anyway, it's not 100% confirmed, but I should have it in the next day or so, and I'll send an email out. So should be fun.
I love L.A. He's a great guy.
Good. Yeah, no, he's got some neat stuff to talk about. So it should be a lot of fun next week as well. And so if there's anybody on that doesn't get my email, just let me know, or... you can always contact us through our website, truthrestoration.com. And I think we're good to go. Thank you guys very much for being on, and thanks for the questions and the comments. And thank you again, Jeff, for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks,
everybody.